right, well, I want to take this time to welcome everybody here tonight. We're very happy to see you. I'm glad that you braved the weather. Actually, when I came up, I saw the sun was shining, which was shocking because when I came in, it looked like it has for the last few weeks, and no sign of sun. Dr. Bernath and I are going to be talking tonight about the treatment of established heart disease. So I'm going to go first, and I'm going to talk about the medical treatment. How do we treat blocked arteries once they're diagnosed? Then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Bernath, and he's going to talk about the more exciting stuff. How do we open the arteries? Okay, what do we do with stents, and what options do we have available to us? And I will make a pitch. If you guys find this informative and you like it, we are going to do a similar presentation at HealthPoint on February 26th. That's 2 weeks from yesterday. So feel free to tell your friends, and we'll try and get a good crowd up there too. All right. So this is what I titled mine. I said, you have heart blockages, so what do we do now? So the first thing I'm going to do is just define what a heart blockage is. Okay, so this is a picture of an artery. And up on top here, this is a normal artery. You can see that in this picture, you see some yellow stuff start to accumulate in the wall of that artery. We call this yellow stuff plaque, all right? And that's made out of cholesterol. It's kind of like a gruel. It's a sticky, waxy substance. And this plaque starts to form in these arteries in teenagers. I mean, this starts young. Over time, this can accumulate more and start to narrow the artery. And you can see in these two pictures, it can be tighter and tighter. The lumen here, or the middle of the artery, the open part, can be squeezed, and that's what we call a narrowing. If that narrowing gets to be tight enough, let's say 70% narrowed, then not enough blood is going to get through, and you're going to get a symptom of chest pain. That's called angina. So that's caused by this substance. Now, this process is called atherosclerosis. So atherosclerosis is the buildup of plaque in the wall of an artery. And when that artery goes to the heart, it's called coronary artery disease, because the coronary arteries are the arteries to the heart. So that's what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about coronary artery disease. Now, this picture shows what can happen, and this is what happens when you have a heart attack. This stable narrowing can rupture, can like a pimple, all right? And this can burst, and the inside of this can be exposed to the blood. And when the inside of a plaque is exposed to the blood, a clot forms. So this closes the artery, and it occurs like this. This is a sudden, unexpected closing of the artery that's caused by a blood clot on top of a plaque. Now, if this happens here, any heart muscle downstream is not going to get any blood. So any heart muscle downstream is going to die. And that is called a heart attack. So a heart attack is the death of heart muscle caused by a blood clot on top of a plaque. This and this are treated completely differently. This is treated with medications and lifestyle for the most part, and that's what I'm talking about. This is stable. This is unstable. This is treated with stents, bypasses, every minute counts. That's what Dr. Bernath is going to talk about. Now, I think it's important just to realize the same process of narrowing of the arteries, is when it happens in the heart, it's happening in other places too. By definition, it never occurs just in one artery. It's always diffuse. So when it occurs in the legs, we call it peripheral arterial disease. And that causes pain in the legs when you walk. When it occurs in the carotid artery that's going to the brain, it's called cerebrovascular disease. All right, and that can threaten blood supply to the brain, and that can cause a stroke. So when we see it in the heart or in the leg or anywhere else, it's always in other places. Okay, so what am I going to talk about? How do we treat this stable plaque? And this stable plaque is treated with a combination. Well, we call that secondary prevention. That's just a definition. If you have a plaque and we want to keep it from getting worse, the cardiologists call that it's prevention, but it's secondary prevention because it's already there. Primary prevention is to prevent it in the first place. So we're going to talk about secondary once it's there. The treatment, medical treatment, is a combination of lifestyle and medications. All right, lifestyle and medications. And I think it's important to realize that lifestyle is more important than medications. All right, you can do more with lifestyle than we can do with all the pills in the world. The prognosis, I think, is much better than people think. So if you come in with a blockage, say you get a stent, you're stable. Your prognosis, you're going to, in all likelihood, you're going to live a long, healthy life after that stent, unless there's complicating factors like weakness of the heart. But the garden variety person who has a blockage is going to do very well. In fact, the prognosis, if you have a blocked artery, the prognosis of a heart attack or stroke or problem in 10 years is on the order of 1 in 4. 3 out of 4 people are going to do very well. So it's when someone comes in and needs a stent, you know, it's always a big deal. And a lot of these guys are, you know, 50-year-old guys who are otherwise healthy. They get a stent and they think it's over. And we spend a lot of time convincing them, if you do the right thing, it's not over. In fact, many people, after they get diagnosed with a blockage, live longer, healthier lives than they would have had they not had the blockage, because it's a wake-up call. So if a guy comes in, you know, he's a smoker, he's overweight, he doesn't exercise, and this blocked artery is the motivation for him to do all the right things, that person is going to live a healthier life and possibly a longer life because he came in to begin with. So that's an important point to remember. So we're talking about secondary prevention here. Today, 2019, I'm going to talk about lifestyle, medications, what probably works, and what doesn't work. Because there's a lot of, like, urban legend, you know, about what works and what doesn't. And things change. Things change over time. So when I came to town, it was 1997, I had no kids. I wasn't even married. Then I got married, had a couple kids. This is a couple years later, and now here we are. As you can see, some things change. My kids look older. My wife looks older. Some things never change. I look the same. All right, so what we're going to talk about is first is exercise. So the exercise guidelines, I'm just giving you the latest, okay, latest, greatest. So the newest exercise guidelines just came out in November of 2018. This is the first update in our guidelines in 10 years. They didn't change much, okay, but we've always said you got to get 150 minutes of exercise a week. That did not change. But what did change is they say you can get this exercise in any duration. I mean, we used to say 10 to 15 minutes was the minimum. Now you get credit for walking from the car to the store. You get credit for going up and down the stairs. You get credit for vacuuming. Any amount of activity counts towards this 150 minutes. We know much more about the benefits of exercise. Okay, we always knew it was good for blood pressure. We always knew it was good for weight. But it is good for a lot more than you would think. The immediate benefit, like once you exercise, decreases anxiety, blood pressure, people sleep better. Long term, it decreases your risk of cancer, heart disease, stroke, dementia. Now they say it prevents Alzheimer's. Lowers blood pressure, diabetes, depression, fall risk goes down, balance improves, bone strength gets better, length and quality of life improve. If we had a pill that did all that, you know everyone would be on board to take that pill, and they'd pay for that pill, you know. This is free. Yet, how many people get their 150 minutes? 20%. 20% of Americans get their 150 minutes of exercise. It's kind of amazing. The other thing, and this is really exciting research that's just coming out in the past couple years. Exercise has an effect on the cellular level, on chromosomes. So in the cell, these chromosomes have arms called telomeres. As you get older, these telomeres shorten. It's kind of like your hair turns gray, it falls out, and your telomeres shorten. Exercise lengthens telomeres. Exercise has an anti-aging effect on the cell. So it literally is the fountain of youth. They say that sitting is the new smoking because we just don't, as a country, get as much exercise. And it's any exercise is good. It's not just walking. Many people can't walk because of bad hips and knees and other things. So this is anything that gets your heart rate up. Okay. Food. Now, our guidelines, the FDA issued in 2015. So they come out every 5 years. But the newest guidelines are from Canada. They just came out January of 2019. Here's the website, Canada.ca Food Guide. In terms of food, now I'm not a food expert. My wife knows more about food than I do, which is good because she generally makes it. But there are trends here that are kind of just reinforcing what we already know. This is not magic. First of all, 50% of deaths from CAD, coronary artery disease, that's what we're talking about, can be attributed to diet. So what do they recommend? Well, a plant-based diet. Vegetables, whole grains, and proteins. And in terms of proteins, they want you to get them from plants, usually from plants. Okay, so there's tons of protein in legumes, nuts, seeds, vegetables. My daughter's been a vegetarian since she was 9 years old. Kids, and she's an athlete. She plays tennis and she runs. And kids are like, well, how do you get enough protein? You know, I mean, how do you get enough protein to be that active? Well, I mean, it's just a classic kind of misunderstanding. You guys ever heard, maybe somebody here has heard of the circus, Ringling Brothers Circus. Well, they had this gorilla called Gargantua. You guys remember Gargantua? Well, it was a long time ago. In the 1940s, they got what they said was the biggest gorilla in the world. He weighed 600 pounds. And I guess, according to what I read, he kind of saved Ringling Brothers. They were going bankrupt. And they advertised this thing as the most vicious, you know, animal on earth. And he was completely rippled. He's a vegetarian, like all gorillas. So if it's good enough for Gargantua, well, it's good enough for my 9-year-old daughter, and it's good enough for us. We don't have to worry about we don't have to consume animal products for protein. Number two, the goal is not to decrease fat. You know, we tried decreasing fat. We said, can't eat fat, eat more carbs, and the whole country became obese in the last, 20 years. That doesn't work, and that's not the goal. The goal is to replace saturated fat with unsaturated fat. So saturated fat comes from meat and dairy. That's basically where it is. It's in some oils, but it's predominantly meat and dairy. So once again, like protein, they want you to get your healthy fat. Healthy fat comes from plants. Third, dairy has been one of the food groups in the United States since the food groups first came out. I mean, that was probably in the 1940s. You know, one of the four basic food groups was dairy. Still there. Now, it's not. Dairy is not a food group. They want you to make water your drink of choice. So water is the drink of choice. They don't say you can't have milk. They don't say you can't have meat. They just say limit it, all right? So this is kind of what we're hearing over and over again from everybody, but their guidelines have an advantage because for the first time ever, there was no representative on the committee here from the dairy industry, from the meat industry, the processed food industry, or the beverage industry. So these, you know, like our guidelines, we have these guys writing them. So they're completely biased because industry is involved. Here they did it without. Fruit juice is like soda. Orange juice is like Coke. Okay, it's not healthy. And so they want you to limit juice as well. There's as much juice, sugar in juice as there is in a pop. Okay, so medications. Medications that prevent heart attacks when you have a blockage. Okay, what are they? Well, everybody with a blockage gets aspirin and everybody gets a statin. So aspirin has been used since 450 BC. Aspirin is in willow bark, and Hippocrates in 450 BC wrote about the benefits of aspirin or of willow bark in decreasing pain and fever. It was actually then patented by Bayer in 1895. So this is what they say one of the most enduringly successful commercial products of all time. Aspirin was the brand name. That was the patented brand in 1890, and then when the brand expired, it's like Kleenex. Now it's just aspirin. But this is really something else. It's called acetylsalicylic acid. So otherwise what we call aspirin. If you have a blocked artery, you need to take 81 to 162 milligrams a day. You can take more, but it's not going to do any good. Your risk of bleeding will go up if you take more, but the benefit won't. You can take a coated aspirin, and that maybe that helps with a little dyspepsia, but it's not going to lower your risk of bleeding. Coated aspirin does not lower the risk of bleeding. Greg, can I give you that? I'm on call. Thanks. I'll take over. Well, I'm just making sure you can get in there. Yeah, thanks. Aspirin lowers the risk of colon cancer. It has other benefits. We don't use it for this reason. And we're not using aspirin if you don't have a blockage much anymore because the risk of bleeding goes up. But if you have a blockage, you should be taking aspirin. It's controversial when it's combined with other blood thinners. So if you're on like Coumadin and you're stable, the use of aspirin has become questionable. And certainly if you have a bleeding problem and you're on Coumadin or Xarelto, one of these blood thinners, we're probably going to stop your aspirin. All right, so there's a lot of people who take aspirin in combination with a blood thinner who probably don't need to take that aspirin. Okay, everybody gets a statin. Statin's a cholesterol drug. It's going to lower your risk of a heart attack 25%. It doesn't matter if your cholesterol is 200, 150, 100, doesn't matter. It lowers your risk the exact same. So that's something most people don't know. The benefit is there regardless of what your cholesterol is. How does it work? This is the blood vessel. This is that cholesterol, you know, what we call the plaque. When this plaque erodes through this lining and bursts, that's a heart attack. All right, so this is the first picture I showed you. See, this is all inflammation. Inflammation erodes the lining. That's why inflammation contributes to heart attacks. When you go on a statin, this is what happens. We shrink this becomes small. The cap or the covering becomes thick. That's good, that's like a scar. And the inflammation goes away or gets reduced. So statins stabilize the plaque. They stabilize the plaque. It doesn't matter what your cholesterol is, you get the benefit because it's going to act on that blood vessel. The dose, you know, is dependent on a couple of things. If you're older than 75, we cut the dose down. Muscle aches, that's the problem with the statin, and everybody knows it, and everybody gets muscle aches, actually, whether they're on statins or not. I have muscle aches right now, and I'm not on a statin. Especially when they come into the office and we say, you need to exercise, and you need to take a statin. And they start to exercise, and they take the statin, and they're sore. So we tend to blame the statin when, in effect, it really only causes muscle inflammation. That's what you worry about in about 1 in 200 people. So I tell people, look, I know this drug you think causes muscle aches. Maybe it does. The side effect of taking it is muscle aches. The side effect of not taking it is a 25% increased risk of a heart attack. So we have to weigh the risk versus the benefit. After a heart attack or a stent, you get another blood thinner. Okay, it's called Plavix or Brilinta. So anybody that has a stent or had a heart attack knows these two medications. These medications are also antiplatelet medications. They also are blood thinners. This is how they work. This is the blood vessel that bursts. When it bursts, it doesn't. Blood clots don't just sit when the blood vessel bursts. Blood clots can't stick. What sticks is platelets. So these purple things, that's what sticks on your skin when you're bleeding, on the blood vessel when it bursts. These platelets start the clot. And these platelets then stick together and they grab the blood cells and form the clot. So if we can stop the platelets, we can stop the clotting. So these medications, Brilinta and Plavix, they stop the platelets. Brilinta is very expensive, $399 a month. Plavix is very cheap, $13 a month. Brilinta is a little bit better, but not that much better. And in fact, this is very controversial, and cardiologists disagree on that, but I can tell you the study that showed Brilinta was better came in 2010 before we were putting in drug-coated stents. And some information more recently that uses all these new drug-coated stents questions how much better Brilinta is. Regardless, it might be better, so that's what we recommend. But if somebody says, I don't want to pay for it, that's fine. We switch into Plavix. Our guidelines tells the cardiologist what to do. The standard of care, they say use Brilinta or Plavix. So they give us a choice. And you don't stay on these medications forever. You stay on them for a year after you have a heart attack, 6 months after a stent, if you haven't had a heart attack, 6 months after a stent, if it's a drug-coated stent, and only 3 months if it's what we call a bare metal stent. So the duration of these drugs varies. Many people stay on them for like ever, and many people don't need to be on that medication forever. Okay, if you have a weak heart, you get put on a medication to strengthen your heart. This is everybody with a blocked artery who has a weak heart. And I'm going to go over these a little quicker to get Greg up here, but you go on a beta blocker and an aspirin if you have a weak heart, but only if you have a weak heart. If you have what we call fluid retention, congestive heart failure, you will also go on one of these medications. So these are optional meds depending on the condition of your heart. If you have a weak heart is when the heart gets big and the squeeze, you know, is not as strong. So this is a picture of this is the main pump here. We call this the left ventricle. This is a big, enlarged, weak heart that these medications treat. If your heart stays weak, you get a defibrillator, or you get offered a defibrillator. A defibrillator is a device that's like a pacemaker. It goes in here, wires go into your heart, and if your heart stops, it restarts your heart. It gives you a shock. So a lot of people are walking around with defibrillators to restart their heart if their hearts are weak. So that's also for a weak heart. Now, just a couple more slides. This is what probably works, okay? Fish oil. If you eat fish twice a week, you don't need a supplement. But if you don't like fish, then where most people would recommend you take 1,000 milligrams of fish oil a couple times a week, two times a week. I'm sorry, fish two times a week or this every day, 1,000 milligrams a day. So fish oils, we used to recommend them. We stopped recommending them. Now we're recommending them again as more and more and more information comes out. Flu shots. Flu shots lower the risk of heart disease because flu shots prevent the flu, which is associated with inflammation. We think that might be the link. So we always recommend flu shots. This is brand new. Brand new, this just came out a couple months ago. These blood thinners that we use for other reasons in low dose can lower your risk of a heart attack. So this medication is used for atrial fibrillation. That's the classic use of a blood thinner, 20 milligrams a day. If you use 2.5 milligrams twice a day, combine it with an aspirin, you have a lower risk. So we don't have too many people we're using this medication on right now to prevent heart attacks, but we'll probably be using it more. So if you came up to me in my office and you said, hey, I'm on this, this, and this, but I'm really worried I'm gonna have another heart attack, what else can I do? This is what else you can do. All right, because the data here is pretty strong that this blood thinner can lower the risk. And alcohol. So the good news, moderate drinkers have a lower risk of heart disease in most studies. Moderate is like one drink a day or two drinks a day. The bad news, heavy drinkers have an increased risk of everything. Heart disease, cancer, mental illness, death. So we don't recommend, you know, people start drinking to lower their risk of heart disease because it's too much of a slippery slope. But if somebody comes in and says, I'm having a glass of wine a night, what do you think? Is that good for my heart? I say, probably it is, you know, because probably it is. Now, it doesn't have to be red wine. The red wine thing, you know, we thought that once, and now the only people that think that are the people that make red wine as they try and market it. So any kind of alcohol probably does the same thing. What does not work? Any supplements don't work. Okay, that's a simple thing. Antioxidants, homocysteine, chelation, does not work. Coenzyme Q10, CoQ10, does not work. You would never know it by listening to the claims. I mean, chelation, you know, it brings calcium and metals out of the bloodstream. They say it can prevent Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, autism, heart disease, all not proven. This is for-profit medicine. Chelation is $3,000 for a normal treatment, $4,000. Insurance won't touch it because it's never been proven to work. But, you know, people are interested in doing anything, so it still gets used, but I do not recommend it, and I don't know anybody who does. CoQ10, same thing. That's lots of urban legend here. It's all fake news. CoQ10 has never been proven to work. Sorry, I'm sure there are people in this room taking CoQ10. You can spend your money on it, and you know, if you think it helps, you can take it. It's not gonna hurt you. And I'm talking about its benefit for the heart. So if you're taking it for a different reason and it's working, keep taking it. It's not gonna hurt you, but it's not gonna prevent a heart attack. Finally, you know, of course we have to treat the other things that cause the heart disease to begin with. That's not part of this talk. Smoking is the big one. I did want to just remind people of the new definition of high blood pressure. So normal blood pressure is now less than 120 over 80. Borderline is 120 to 130. High blood pressure is 130 to 140. So 130 to 140 and 80 to 90, that's now high blood pressure. And what we used to call high blood pressure, you know, it was 140 over 90, that's now stage two. So we keep lowering the targets for blood pressure. If you have heart disease, most people are saying you got to treat to get back here. This borderline blood pressure, that's where we want you if you have heart disease. So we want you less than 130 and less than 80. All right, that's generally home readings. So conclusions. Most people live active, healthy lives after being diagnosed with coronary artery disease. It is definitely not a death sentence. A combination of lifestyle and medications can offer tremendous protection. Care guidelines are always evolving, always evolving. Cardiac rehab can help put it all together. We have a great cardiac rehab program here. They know all the latest and greatest recommendations, and it's a great program. And when all else fails, we call Dr. Bernath. We're calling Dr. Bernath right now. Thank you. Please.
We're going to shift gears a little bit now, and what we're going to talk about is interventional cardiology, invasive, and interventional cardiology at Holland Hospital. What do we mean by invasive? Well, invasive means involving entry into the living human body. And what do we do with that? Well, sometimes we intervene to improve the outcome and course of a condition. So if we find that there's significant blockage of an artery, we sometimes work to try to improve the blood flow to change the course of the condition. Last year at Holland Hospital, we did 750 diagnostic cardiac catheterizations and 265 interventions, or as we call them, PCIs, percutaneous coronary interventions. When do we do these procedures? Well, it's following heart disease prevention, as Dr. Frauenheim reviewed. It's after non-invasive testing is performed, such as stress testing, and after guideline-directed medical therapy, such as aspirin, statins, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers in some cases, and nitrates. And when we have exhausted our use of these, at this point, we now do an invasive evaluation and possible intervention. Sometimes it consists of a right heart catheterization. And the reason we do a right heart catheterization is to measure right heart pressures, to measure the output from the heart, and we use various approaches. Sometimes we go from the groin, the femoral vein, internal jugular vein in the neck, or an antecubital vein sort of above the elbow. And this is a diagram of a right heart catheterization. Here it's going in from the right arm, and the catheter goes into the right side of the heart, into the right atrium here, right ventricle, pulmonary artery, and then we can place it out to the lungs, where we can indirectly measure pressures on the left side of the heart. And we may do that if we suspect that people are in heart failure, if we want to know what their pressures are within inside their heart to see whether they need more diuretics. And sometimes it helps in evaluating or supplementing information we have regarding valvular heart disease. Left heart catheterization, well, same kind of fashion, we measure left heart pressures. It allows us to look at the coronary anatomy, to look at the arteries to see whether they're clean or whether they're narrowed or significantly blocked. It helps us evaluate valvular heart disease, the mitral valve, the aortic valve. And approaches are from the groin, the femoral artery, and the radial artery or the wrist, which we probably about 80% now are done from the wrist. Much easier for the patient as far as mobility afterwards. And this is a diagram of the coronary arteries. What we have here is we have the ascending aorta. So this is where the blood flows out of the heart, crosses the aortic valve, and then passes up into the aorta. And here it goes to the right arm, the right side of the head, left side of the head, and then over to the left arm, and then moves on down into the abdomen. On its way up into the aorta, though, it also goes down these coronary arteries. And this is the right coronary artery. This is called the left main artery, and it gives rise to this artery along the front wall of the heart called the left anterior descending, and this artery along the back wall of the heart called the circumflex. And also in this diagram, it shows grafts. This is a vein graft from the aorta down to the right coronary artery, and this is the internal mammary artery that sometimes is used to bypass the artery along the front wall of the heart, or the LAD. And what I want to show you is just a left heart catheterization, just kind of a video of that, and I've got to go over to this screen here.
A coronary angiography, or cardiac catheterization, is an X-ray examination of the vessels and chambers of the heart, often done to identify any narrowed or clogged coronary arteries that are preventing blood from reaching the heart muscle. The study can also be used to measure the size and function of the chambers of the heart and the function of the heart valves. When you arrive at the hospital, an intravenous line will be started. You will be placed on a heart monitor, and you may be given an oral or intravenous sedative to help you relax. Most coronary angiography procedures last between 1 and 2 hours. Before the procedure, you will be placed on a table equipped with a fluoroscope, an X-ray imaging device. During the procedure, the fluoroscope will move around your chest in all directions to record pictures of your heart and coronary arteries from multiple angles. Most cardiac catheterizations take place through the femoral artery in the groin, but can also be done through an artery in the arm. The doctor numbs the skin in your groin area and inserts a needle into your femoral artery. Once the needle is placed, a wire is passed through the needle and gently guided through the arterial system to the heart. The needle will be withdrawn and exchanged for a small flexible tube called a sheath that permits access to your femoral artery. Next, a soft, flexible catheter will be slipped over the wire through the sheath and threaded up to your heart. Your physician will watch the movement of the catheter on the fluoroscope. You may feel pressure as the wire and sheath are inserted, but you will not feel their movement inside your arteries. To evaluate the coronary arteries, your doctor will remove the guide wire, position the tip of the catheter just inside the arteries, one at a time, and inject a special dye. This dye allows the fluoroscope to take X-ray images, called angiograms, of the artery's interior. Any blockages will be clearly identified as the arteries fill with dye. You may feel flushed or slightly nauseated when the dye is injected. After sufficient images of both coronary arteries and their tributaries have been recorded, the catheter will be removed through the groin. Pressure must be applied over the femoral artery to prevent bleeding. You will then be taken to the recovery room for 30 to 60 minutes of observation, after which you will be required to lie on your back for several hours with a pressure bandage in place over your groin. You may either be discharged home on the same day or after an overnight stay in the hospital.
As I mentioned, though, the majority of the catheterizations we're doing today are from the radial artery, so some of that video was a little inaccurate. So it's possible that even with an abnormal non-invasive test, such as a stress test, that you have normal results. Normal arteries. We call that a false positive test. If normal arteries, the test may not tell us what is causing your symptoms, but tells us what isn't causing your symptoms. If abnormal catheterization results, then the options may be medical therapy, percutaneous intervention, angioplasty, or bypass surgery. Sometimes it's difficult to, when we do evaluate the degree of narrowing, it's sometimes dependent on the artery that we're looking at. A 60% in the left main artery is more significant than a 90% sometimes in a small branch of an artery. But generally, we consider mild coronary artery disease, less than 50% narrowing, moderate coronary artery disease, 50 to 70%, and usually severe narrowing, greater than 70%. But sometimes it's difficult to evaluate the degree of narrowing objectively, and sometimes we rely on other methods rather than just the visual appearance. Because sometimes an artery will look like it's 80% narrowed, and you think, oh, that must be significant. But when we measure the hemodynamics across that artery, it's not. And sometimes a 60% may not look significant, but when we measure pressures, it is. And so we have various tools available. And one is what's called the fractional flow reserve, and another is the instant wave free ratio, and intravascular ultrasound, and that allows us to actually look directly into an artery. And I know those are kind of technical terms, but I'll try to demonstrate exactly what we're looking at. So FFR and IFR use pressure wires, and they measure pressures on both sides of the area of narrowing to more accurately determine the significance of the coronary artery blockage. And it's been shown that if the FFR is less than 0.8, patients did better with intervention, such as balloon angioplasty and stenting, than if it was greater than 0.80. As I mentioned here, if the FFR is greater than or equal to 0.80, medical therapy provided excellent long-term results. In fact, a more or less a five-year guarantee that there's not going to be an issue with that artery, or as we call it, major adverse coronary events. Intravascular ultrasound allows actual visualization within the artery to determine the significance of the blockage. And this is the pressure wire. And what we have here is a wire that's delivered by a catheter, and we cross the area of narrowing with this wire. And it allows us to simultaneously measure pressures here and here. And if we can see that there's a significant drop off in pressure as the blood flows through this area, it tells us that that is significant blockage. blockage. So it's an objective way rather than just the visual reflex of determining whether the degree of narrowing is significant. And this is a picture of an ultrasound, or actually looking inside the blood vessel with ultrasound waves. And this shows us, the green area shows us the plaque that's within that artery. And here you can see the probe had passed beyond the blockage, and then we pull back and we can actually see from a normal artery to this abnormal artery to a normal artery. So it actually allows visualization, and so we can actually measure the diameter directly. And this is just another picture. This is kind of a cross-sectional view of narrowing. You can see some hemorrhaging within this plaque. And this is kind of a longitudinal view where we start out with the normal artery, normal walls here, and we can see this plaque here and here, narrowing here, kind of tortuous right here, and then widens out. So sometimes we'll use the pressure measurements to determine the significance. Sometimes we'll use the intravascular ultrasound. And this is just another example of a normal artery, and then this is the abnormal artery with plaque around the inside. And what we just see here is just a catheter. When narrowing is determined to be significant, then a stent-supported balloon angioplasty can be performed. And what we have here, we have an artery that has the normal here, but the plaque with cholesterol buildup, as Dr. Frauenheim demonstrated. And what we plan on doing in this case, we plan on opening this artery. So we've determined that this is a significant area of narrowing. We cross it with a wire, and then over that wire pass a balloon. And wrapped tightly around that balloon is a stent. It's almost like a spring or a slinky or like a chicken wire. But it's wrapped very tightly around this balloon. We inflate the balloon, deploying this stent, and then deflate the balloon, pulling back the balloon and the wire, and leaving this stent-supported artery open. And following that, then it's important to continue to use aspirin and the Plavix and Brilinta that Dr. Frauenheim mentioned in order to prevent blood clots from being attracted to this foreign material, the stent. And this is just another view. Here we have an artery that has narrowing, kind of eccentric here, and they passed a balloon that has a stent wrapped around it, and here the stent is being deployed, expanding the narrowing within that artery.
Angioplasty is a procedure to open narrowed or blocked arteries caused by deposits of plaque. If the blockage is not major, the problem may be corrected by inflating the balloon several times to compact the plaque against the arterial wall, widening the passage for the blood to flow through. Typically, a device called a stent is placed within the coronary artery to keep the vessel open.
Percutaneous coronary intervention, also known as coronary angioplasty, opens narrowed coronary arteries. A catheter inserted in an artery in the groin or arm is threaded to the affected artery. A second catheter is then inserted inside the first one. When the catheter reaches the narrowed area, a balloon on its tip is inflated to reopen the artery. While the catheters are in the artery, a stent may be placed to prevent re-narrowing after an artery is widened.
Our goal is to try to do it in less than 60 minutes, although the guidelines say it's less than 90 minutes is acceptable. But we try to get it faster than that because we know that time is muscle. So these procedures are not curative, but they can help to manage symptoms and reduce the risk of further problems. So unfortunately, we don't have a cure for coronary artery disease, but we do have ways to minimize the development and reduce the risks. There are times, however, that during a heart attack or a complicated intervention, that the heart as a pump is not functioning well and needs support. In these situations, we can employ short-term mechanical protection, such as an intra-aortic balloon pump, to help relieve some of the work that the heart has to do. And we can also implant a device within the left ventricle that actually pumps for the heart. And I'll also have some videos of that.
An intra-aortic balloon pump, or IABP, is an inflatable balloon that is surgically implanted into the aorta to help the heart pump blood to the body and to help improve blood flow to the coronary arteries. When the heart is at rest, the balloon inflates, helping the blood flow through the coronary arteries to the heart muscle. When the heart begins to contract, the balloon rapidly deflates, causing the blood from the heart to flow more forcefully into the aorta and out to the body. This device can be used for patients who have recently had a heart attack or are waiting for a heart transplant. An intra-aortic balloon pump, or IABP, is an inflatable balloon that is surgically...
And the next thing I want to demonstrate is this Impella or left ventricular assist device. We actually are putting a pump within the heart.
The Impella is the world's smallest heart pump. The cardiologist places the Impella heart pump into position using standard cardiac catheterization techniques, inserting the catheter into the leg artery and guiding it into the heart. Once in place, the Impella pump is turned on, providing support to the heart while monitoring the pumping activity. The Impella pump mimics the natural pathway of blood flow from the heart to the ascending aorta, increasing blood pressure while unloading the heart and providing more blood supply to vital organs such as the brain and kidneys. A protected PCI procedure with Impella could lead to less days in the hospital, fewer repeat procedures, and an improved quality of life for the patient.
So all these devices that I've discussed are available here at Holland Hospital. The bottom line is that if you think you're having a heart attack, call 911. Upon arrival of the paramedics, they can analyze and begin life-saving treatment. They can notify the receiving hospital and mobilize the heart team. Unfortunately, probably less than 10% call for help. The issue is that a heart attack rarely is fatal, but cardiac arrest is about 95% fatal, and that's our biggest fear with a heart attack is cardiac arrest, where the heart stops or goes into a life-threatening rhythm. But if the paramedics notify the receiving hospital, we mobilize our team, and we'll be waiting for you. Bluntly speaking, don't be one of those patients that has a cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital, or even as we've seen in the parking lot of the emergency room with all the family in the back seat of the car. And as I was researching videos for this talk, I ran across this interesting video, and see what you think.
He's not breathing anymore.
Please stay calm. What's your name?
Joanna.
Good. Joanna, we've got your location. The ambulance drone is on its way. Remove his top shirt to uncover his torso.
Okay.
Great. Can you go to the nearest exit? The ambulance drone is almost there.
Okay. I'm outside.
I'll be talking through the drone now, so you can put down the phone.
Now please pick up the drone and bring it to your father.
You're doing great.
pull the green lid. Now place the pads on your father's chest. Good, I can see that the pads are properly applied. Joanna, please stay clear of your father. We'll take it from here.
All right, well, thank you guys very much.
Thank you very much for coming out in this weather.
Well, thank you.